Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Indeed. Yeah, we're going to talk about The Charwoman's Shadow by Lord Dunsany. And that's the pronunciation I am going with.
Okay.
Is it Dunsany or Dunsany? I've heard both. So
who knows and who cares?
That's right.
Dunsany. That's where we are.
Dunsany, yeah. So I came across this book. I discovered this list of books called the Ballantine Adult Fantasy Series.
Oh.
I don't know if you've heard of that.
Huh.
So it was a series of books that were published between May 1969 and April 1974 that were fantasies, and they were edited by Lynn Carter.
I have heard that name.
Yep. So I remember when I first came across the list, I looked at a few things. There are things on there like The Nightland, which I thought was amazing. But these are generally books that predate Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So those kind of fantasies, and they were being republished under the Ballantine name. And I read, the first one I read was The King of Elfland's Daughter, but also by Lord Dunsany.
Right.
And I loved it. I really liked it. And so there was another book on the list, and it was this one, The Charwoman's Shadow by Lord Dunsany. And I just, there's just something about these old fantasies that really appeals to me. Some of the other ones on there, The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by Lovecraft. That was an interesting one. One that I have but haven't read yet is called The Blue Star by Fletcher Pratt.
I know Fletcher Pratt's name because didn't he write with Elsbrig Camp?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, writing, The Complete Enchanter, I think, is what those are called.
Yeah, about Harold Shea, who inadvertently goes back in time or kind of into these sideways, into these like mythological stories. Yeah.
Yeah. I've read some of other people on the list, there's Clark Ashton Smith and William Morris, George MacDonald. I have Lilith. Lilith is on the list, and I haven't read it yet. But I did read The Broken Sword. Paul Anderson is on here. The Broken Sword is one that I really liked.
I think I've read that. That was good.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
So anyway,
right.
It's a cool list. There's like 65 books on there.
Huh.
And
so far,
everything I've read, I've really liked, including this one. And this one, to me, it had this, like I'm reading it, and it felt like it was brushing up against the mystery, you know? The way a lot of these older fantasies have, and I think newer fantasies like epic fantasy doesn't really have. It's
right.
There's this quality to it, this mythic ancient quality to it that I really, really like. And I'm so far I keep finding it in what I'm reading out of this list anyway.
Okay.
So that's where it came from. And I read it and I said, oh, we should talk about that. So it was published, originally published in 1926. So, you know, obviously the Ballantine was a republication and very cool cover. Paperback. Ballantine. Yeah, so good stuff. So what this is, it's this takes place in Spain in the Golden Age, whatever that is. I don't know that there is any real historical period called the Golden Age in Spain.
It felt like a golden age of magic.
Yes, that's what
like
I'm thinking
that.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's during the Golden Age, right? And there's this lord, and he wants to marry his daughter to some neighbor. And but they need to take care of this dowry. So he sends his son to a magician to learn how to make gold out of whatever. It's not specified, but we need to do some alchemy here and we need to make some gold so we can be rich. And while he's there, this kid, and his name is Ramon, while Ramon is at this magician, charwoman comes. And a charwoman, my understanding is she's like someone who cleans, right? Like a cleaning woman in a castle.
Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, she shows up, but the weird thing is she has no shadow. It has been taken from her, her shadow, and she is distraught over that all the time. So now Ramon is given some choices because what he wants to learn has a price. So this magician does not work for free. He's like, you know, here's the price. If you want to learn this, it's this, you know, but if you want to learn how to make gold, you're going to give up your shadow. So Ramon has to make that decision. So really, I'm not sure how much more to say outside of spoilers, but that is the setup. And now Ramon is moving forward. He's growing deep feelings for this charwoman who's an older woman.
Older? She's an ancient crone.
Right, very old, that's right? Yes. Thank you for not saying like that.
She's 40 and he's 20 now.
Very true, thank you. She's an ancient crone. That's yes. Good. Yeah. So he's determined to get her shadow back. And so this is in his mind. And so as he moves forward, he's got decisions to make about what he'll give up for certain things. And anyway, is there anything else you would say pre-spoiler?
I would say at a certain point, we also get to see a little bit of his sister's story.
Mm-hmm.
The sister's the one who's going to get married.
Yeah.
And that part of the story, I don't know, it was like the second leg that the story stands on somehow to me.
Sure, yeah.
And I found it interesting.
Okay, good.
So, yeah. So it's, you know, about the two kids. I mean, mostly Ramon.
Right, mostly Ramon. And I would say, too, Christianity is here. Spain, there's a Father Joseph who I liked very much.
Yes, he was great.
But they're in Christian Spain during this golden age. It's like a fantasy Spain with Catholicism still present.
Yes, because you happen to know that, because if you see someone without a shadow, you know the devil's going on.
That's
so you
right.
Kill them.
It is something right now. Weird happening there. Yeah, I love it.
We don't care for it.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And God is invoked many times.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very clear.
Yeah. And the writing style is, you know, so far everything I've read by Lord Dunsany, and there's been about four things now, I've really, really liked. So I need to do a deep dive in him, but or continue on it anyway. But his writing style, to me, it didn't take very long to adjust myself. I don't know how you felt, but here's like a typical thing. For myself, if the getting of gold be an art, as some have said, I am past the time for learning a new art. And if it be a sin, my sins are over. Yet you, my son, may haply gather this great necessity for us, or this evil, whatever it be. And if it be a sin, what is one more sin to youth? Not much, I fear. Right? That's his dad talking him into going to learn how to make gold. You know.
Thanks, Dad.
But that's the style in which this is written.
Yeah, it is definitely a fairy tale style, and kind of a dreamy fairy tale style.
Right.
And so one of the things that I liked, let's see if I can get this highlight. So some of the stuff is modern, because Lord Dunsany was writing in what I would call modern times, so 100 years ago, but still.
Yeah.
So like this, to me, it's kind of an example of something that made me laugh, because it was so beautifully wandering and fantasy-like, but it was also, to me, very modern. So the says, gladly then the Lord of the Tower and Rocky Forest went to his rummage room, where strange things lay and none interfered with the spider. And in that dim place, where one scarce could have hoped to find anything, amongst heaps of old fishing nets that had become solid with dust, where worn-out boar spears lay on the floor, and rusted bandoleros that had once pricked famous bulls, blunt knives and broken broken tent pegs, and things too old for one to be able to name them at all, unless one washed them and brought them out in the light. Groping amongst all these, the Lord of the Tower found a pale heap of boar's tusks and the scroll among them, as he had told his son, and then he left the place to the spider. And I just like the idea of, first of all, the Lord of the Tower's got a junk room. It makes it sound like, and then there was this and that. And I'm like, no, this is old fishing nets and old spears. And this is where everything, tent pegs.
Yep.
It was like, so it's written in this beautiful kind of dreamy way. And you can imagine everything all thrown together. And like they say, the spider. So there's webs everywhere. But I was like, it's his junk room.
Yeah.
I don't know why that tickled me, but it just did.
No, it tickles me too. It's the whole style of it. But I love that. It's like, okay, yeah. It's atypical to just say, you know, the subject of this is the spider.
Yes.
You know, which is like nature, you know, kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the way that it feels. It's like the spider's a character. And it changes your perspective. It's like, oh, thinking about this spider sitting there and happily, but this guy comes in and he's going to rummage through his rummage. So
his rummage room. I like that.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. And also, I guess I just like the way that Lord Dunsany will just take these weird by routes and just kind of contemplate other things sometimes. Mm. Although this rummage room actually probably isn't a good example of that. But you don't expect to be dragged through the rummage room, all the things he's sorting through to find the boar's tusks. And he is quite descriptive, and he's so descriptive that I would say it's best to read it in small pieces, a chapter or two at a time, for me.
Yep.
Because if I read it too long, I would finally start going, I get it. Three sentences of action happen. Now we've got four paragraphs of this stuff going on. And so if I read it in smaller pieces, I could enjoy all of it. And otherwise, I was like, no. No time for this wandering around.
Yeah.
One must keep going.
Yeah. My attention would wander. I hear you. And there's some of this that I like a ton. I don't know if it's kind of pushback against the modern stuff, but, you know, I mentioned epic fantasy. I don't read a lot of epic fantasy. I mean, I love The Lord of the Rings, but The Lord of the Rings is a good example of taking a little bit of time and looking around. We've talked about that before. And I have grown, as I get older, I think, to really appreciate that. So I recently read a book called The Shadow of the Gods by John Gwynne, which was a book that I read with a book club that I'm in. And I could tell, it's like, you know, Lord of the Rings has a point besides what the battles are. You know, some people love Lord of the Rings because it has battles, right? But if you read Lord of the Rings, there's this depth and this undercurrent of all this stuff that, and we've talked about it quite a bit, that exists there. And that's why I like it. The battles are something that are occurring in reaction to the forces at play. Mm-hmm. But there's fantasies written that just are about the battles, right? You know, so that's what this one was. It was like fighting, fight. You know, there's every chapter someone died. There were swords and axes and all this stuff. So it was like taking the piece of the Lord of the Rings that I was slightly interested in, but you turn that up to 11 and say, this is everything there is. And it's fairly popular. People really like it, but really it's just, this is cool battle stuff, right?
Well, it's one note.
Yeah. So exactly, one note. And it's like reading some of the space opera, which I've grown a little weary with, which is just setting up space battles, right? Which is like when you watch Star Trek, there are space battles and those are cool. But for some, the space battles are the coolest thing that there is, right? So it's like, you know, that's what they think Star Trek is. I was talking to one guy about Deep Space Nine one time, and he says, there's not enough fighting in... I was like, oh my gosh, you know? And I'm thinking, oh, this is such some deep stories here. This is really great. And but, you know, for him, that wasn't interesting to him. It was the setting up the battle stuff, so... But now here, I really like this dwelling on stuff like that. That paragraph that you read is gold. It's like, there's just something about it that draws me in, and I'm imagining the room, and I'm imagining these nets on the ground and the boar's tusks and all this stuff from his life in a paragraph, you know? And to me, I love that. There's just something about that is really terrific that I don't think we're getting a lot in modern fiction. And so I don't know. For me, I don't know what it is, but I'm getting enamored with that kind of stuff. And, you know, this whole, you know, what they teach you in conventions and stuff, like if you're going to a writing class, it's like, oh, start the action as late as possible. You know, we no messing around here. You've got to grab attention and all this other stuff. Is like, wow, well, let's look around for a minute.
So there's start the action as late as possible?
No, you start, the advice is always you start the story when the action is taking place. You don't, okay, like, if you I feel see. Like you need to explain things before the action, you've got to come up with a way to just start, you know.
Got it.
He was fighting okay. right then, or, you know, right. she cut his head off, you know, that's the first right. line. And then you're like, oh, how did that happen? You know, and then, so that's the advice of.
Instead of, it was going to be Bilbo's 11th.
Exactly
birthday,
right.
111th birthday.
Yeah. So Tolkien aww, himself would be.
A big party.
Yeah. He would be advised, no, we need to start this in Bree or something like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I got it.
Yeah. So here, this book is like, picture a summer. This is the first line. Picture a summer evening, somber and sweet over Spain, the glittering sheen of leaves fading to soberer colors, the sky in the west all soft and mysterious as low music, and in the east like a frown. Picture the golden age past its wonderful zenith and westering now towards its setting. And you're like, yeah. He would have been told, no, that's not allowed.
I read that sentence 3 times.
Yep.
It was so beautiful, and I just stopped and actually really thought about it. And that's why I was saying I had to read it in pieces, because you know I'm a very fast reader.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I can dwell on things usually if I know the story already. Mm-hmm. Then I go back and dwell on the things you're talking about. But this, I really liked that writing, but I was discovering if I read more than like 2 or 3 chapters in a row, which the chapters are pretty short, then I would find myself speeding up and I go, nope, go back to the beginning of this chapter.
That's cool.
You just can do that tomorrow.
It's cool that you felt like you should slow down. That's neat.
Well, yeah, because he's putting so much in of those long descriptions and things. And it is, it's so evocative and of place and time. And yeah, it's really beautiful. And oftentimes he is looking at something in the middle of all this description that you don't expect. So, crud, I think I might have lost my bookmark again. So one of the things is that the reason the father thinks that the son can ask the magician for a favor is because the son's grandfather did a favor for the magician by teaching him how to boar hunt.
Yeah, how to hunt boar.
Yeah, yep. And you would not think that would be a big favor. So Ramon brings that up when he's met the magician, who's called the master. And he says, and the magician says, of the things you shall learn here earliest, the prime is this, that the pursuit of the philosophers is welfare. To this gold often contributes, often it thwarts it. But it was plainly taught by your grandfather that the hunting of boars is amongst those things that bring pure joy to man. This study must therefore always be preferred to such as only bring us happiness incompletely, or that have been known to fail to bring it at all, such as the hunting of boars never failed. So I learned from your grandfather. Hmm. And the young man says, oh, well, you know, my grandfather wasn't really a learned man, didn't have enough time for it. He wasn't a philosopher. And the master says, your grandfather was a very great philosopher. Not only had he found the way to happiness, but of that way was a most constant explorer, for none may doubt that he knew its every turning. And then he talks exhaustively about boar hunting.
Yeah.
And he says, and took its, and eventually says, and took its tusky head, which was his happiness, and rarely failed to achieve it, having so deeply studied the way. I also have followed the pursuit of happiness, studying all those methods that are most in use amongst men, as well as some that are hidden from them. And most of those methods are in vain, leaving few that are worthy of the investigation of one holding the rank that I now hold amongst wizards. It says, of these few that have stood the test of my most laborious analysis, is this one that I owe to the researches of your grandfather, and which, seeing how few are the ways of attaining happiness, is certainly among the four great branches of learning, which I'm like, again, here's his touch of humor, boar hunting. It says, the young man was surprised at the value the master placed upon boar hunting, for having as yet learned nothing about philosophy, he vaguely and foolishly believed it to be concerned with mere intricate words and did not know in his youthful ignorance that its real concern was with happiness.
Yeah.
And so, and then the narrator goes on to talk about Ramon some. But I loved that he stops to make that point, because throughout the whole book, things that don't seem to matter to your happiness are the things that you need for happiness, like your own shadow.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And he says, you know, right here, like what you just read, you know, the pursuit of philosophers is welfare. To this, gold often contributes, often it thwarts it.
Yes.
And Ramon is there for gold, you know?
Yes.
So he's telling him exactly what you just said in, you know, it's the old, you know, how many countless ancient stories do we have about, you know, be careful what you wish for. You know, you have the three wishes stories where some genie says, you know, you have three wishes, and yeah, you know, what people think that they want, the material stuff, is not really of the greatest value. And that is part of why I love this book.
Well, yeah. And it's interesting too, because Ramon is doing this out of disinterest at first.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to help his sister. It's out of loyalty and fidelity to his father and to his family and sister.
Yeah.
But he's been warned not to give up your shadow, no matter what you do.
Yeah.
By the charwoman.
By the charwoman, yeah.
Yeah.
And the charwoman is so distraught over having lost this. And mm-hmm. he's like, this is no big deal. What are you talking about?
My sweet young shadow.
Yeah. And you can, you know, for me, as I read it, you know, the shadow became a symbolic of a lot of things. A lot of, you know, like when Father Joseph discovered it, that he, not only had he let his shadow go, but he had a fake one. So it was like, that was almost reminiscent of having committed some sin, but pretending that you never did, you know? So it's like, you know, and then the priest is the one who dispelled the fake shadow. And I thought that was pretty awesome.
That's right. I forgot that.
Yeah. So, but there is something inner that's going on with the shadow. It's like, I don't know if it's like a connection to the spiritual world. Again, this is something that it's like, it's scratching on something that you can't quite grab. At least that's how I felt about it, because, so Ramon eventually gives up his shadow in order to learn how to do the gold. Right. And he's given this fake one, and he thinks it's just as good. So he goes to the charwoman, who's been telling him how horrible it is to have lost your shadow. And he actually went through it and gave it away. And then he comes back and says, look at my fake shadow. Isn't it awesome? You know, maybe we can get you one of these. And it's not until he goes out in public and people realize that's weird. There's something not right about this, you know? And, you know, to me, again, that you can connect it to sin or your spiritual progression or the state of your soul, because other people are noticing that it's wrong, and he's trying to pretend like it's not, right?
As the light changes, it's one size.
Yes, right.
It doesn't change as the light changes and your reflection is.
It doesn't lengthen or shorten with the sun. So therefore, he is only, I would say, quote unquote, welcome to be in a crowd unless the sun's in a certain spot. And but even then, his reputation of having a fake shadow has spread, and even then he can't even be out during at that time. So he's shunned completely.
Right. Yeah. And so the shadow is something that's ephemeral. You can't hold it or put your hands on it, but it's something you can see that the people around him are looking at and saying, as you're saying, something's not quite right.
Right.
It's those little indicators that where you go, this seems off.
Right.
You know, and it's, you're right, somebody's hiding something and they can't talk about it right, or they haven't experienced this thing and they're pretending, or that you can tell sometimes about other people. And certainly when it's something that you know about, it obsesses you.
Yeah.
You keep about it. You keep, how do I fix it? How do I get around it? How do I ignore it? And the shadow, it gradually obsesses him. And one of the things in the story that I loved, I read it two or three times, was the description of how when he gets his shadow back, it rushes towards his feet, and then they dance together.
Yeah.
And that's, I just awesome, loved that natural joy in becoming whole. And it rushed to him. It wanted to be whole. He wanted to be whole. The parts of him that weren't able to be held onto or touched, you know.
Yeah.
I just loved that.
I love it too. I think it's great. And then the charwoman gets her shadow back. And that is really interesting because it's almost as if the shadow is casting her, because her shadow is of a much younger person, and that he didn't recognize it. He's looking through this box of shadows and can't find hers. And she's like, this is the one, right? That's the one. But when she's reunited with her shadow, it changes her physical appearance, as if, again, the shadow is casting her. And that, to me, is like spiritual life coming forward. Somehow your inner self is now seen.
And her soul, I thought.
Yeah, her, right, her soul. And so I thought that was an interesting contrast.
Yeah. He hadn't been without his very long.
Right, true.
And she'd been without hers for maybe centuries,
a good long time. Yeah, whatever it was.
Yeah. And so
very long time, because when they went back to town, she was a legend. You know, she's somebody who lived in this house that had left and never returned, but they kept lighting a candle in her window for who knows how long. It was a long time, because there was some money set aside. You're reading this. They said, at the first, we did this, but we kept doing it, because it was that. And that whole conversation was interesting, because, they're like, you guys are unnatural. There's something going on here that we can't have. And they're trying to explain themselves. And that was an interesting deal too.
Yeah. And it was interesting too, because she was promised immortality, right? She would never die.
Yeah.
But she wasn't promised that she wouldn't grow old.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But her shadow kept her true self, her youth, for her.
Yeah. Right.
So beautiful. Did she become mortal again when she got her shadow?
I don't know. Could be. I'm not sure.
She marries Ramon.
She does at the end. Yeah. Yeah. And I love at the very beginning, I mean, the Christianity, or Father Joseph shows up right at the very beginning.
Yeah, he's
because
great.
His father is trying to explain this. He says, you're going to go learn magic from this guy. And then Ramon says, the black art, how shall I tell this to Father Joseph? And I was like, cool. We have a decent priest in this story. And it turns out, I mean, he's more than decent. He is the person everybody keeps going to. It's like he advises every one of these characters, tells them, they come to him for advice. And he can tell something's wrong when something's wrong. He just has a feeling, and he starts digging. There was lots of good Father Joseph moments, I thought.
I know. It says, this is when the Lord of the Tower is like, so we're going to have Ramon go and do this thing, and because we need money. We need something to fill up our coffer for the dowry. And he says, I've got some great fabric. Would you like to try it out? And he goes, no, fabric's not what I'm talking about. And he's like, I thought so. It says, before this, it says, and Father Joseph sat there, rubicund, affable, blinking, a study for anything rather than thought. Yet years of familiarity with incomplete confessions had given him a knack with the loose ends of parts of stories that enabled him to unravel them almost without thinking. This he had done already with the story now before him, but he desired to be sure, for he was a careful man. And I do love him. And it made me think of Father Brown. Have you ever read any of the Father Brown mysteries?
I haven't. I think I've seen a TV show. I don't know how many have been done, but I feel like I've seen them. Yeah.
And those are by G.K. Chesterton. Uh-huh. And I'm reading through them because I have another book that's called The Metaphysical Mysteries of G.K. Chesterton. Mm-hmm. So it's talking about the underlying meanings of a lot of these mysteries that I've never caught, of course. And of course, the whole conceit is that Father Brown is, he's not very, he looks kind of stupid, really. Mm-hmm. And but what happens is because he's heard so many confessions, because he's lived the life of a priest, it's kind of like Miss Marple in the Agatha Christie stories, if you've ever read any of those. She's just like, oh, well, the housemaid, it's just like this housemaid over here. And Father Brown will say, oh, yes, well, I know because of this, that to think about things in a different way. And this Father Joseph really reminded me of it. So I wondered, yeah. I kept thinking, did he like the Father Brown stories? Don't say any.
Yeah, so, sure could have.
Anyway.
Yeah, Father Joseph is wise. You know, there's another part where he says, now in all the, well, this is Dunsany, I think. This is the narrator. Mm-hmm. Now in all the confessions he had heard from men that had enemies, he had noticed that none went back from their journeys by the same way by which they had come, as Ramon Alonso had done. You know, it's just like these little observations. So yes, he knows there's something wrong and he's trying to tease it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's cool that they all look to him though. Yeah. And, there's another part that I liked, where Father Joseph is talking to a guy named Gonsalvo.
The one who wants to marry Mirlando?
Yes.
Is that her name, Mirlando?
Yeah. Yeah, his sister, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Father Joseph says, the power of the Holy Church is waning. It is not what it was in the good days. And Gonsalvo says, alas. And there were looks of commiseration toward Father Joseph. And Father Joseph says, it is because of all this sin that there has been in the world of late. And the commiserating looks change all of a sudden, for they knew that Father Joseph knew all their sins. Then the Lady of the Tower took the flagon, thinking that perchance the Duke might drink if no word were said about food. You know, so this is when the Duke is down. You know, he is ill.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's down. He drank the potion.
I know, and that was a part that really surprised me. There were several parts where things would twist around, because you're going through this and it's got so many familiar beats, right? Yeah. I mean, like, and even if you're not ready for a particular thing, it fits into the pattern. So when Ramon feels this sense of chivalry toward the charwoman, even though she's an old crone and he's going to get nothing out of it, he feels so bad that he says he's going to get her shadow back. Well, then he's got to do it.
Mm.
And he goes to great lengths to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And doing tasks that he would never have done before, which are very difficult for him, even though it's like trying all these syllables of which pronunciation of something can get this lock open.
Yes.
And but so then there are things, though, that I didn't expect at all, because there's the love potion. He gives it to his sister. Gonsalvo is there, and the Duke, who he serves, is there. And she takes a chalice and she gives it to Gonsalvo. And then she gives one to the Duke. And I went, oh, wait, hold on. What's happening here?
What are you doing?
She doesn't have to give it to Gonsalvo. I just thought of that.
That is funny.
It was, and also the way the love potion worked.
Yeah.
Was that not unusual?
It was. I mean,
yeah, it just made him furious with everybody he saw except Mirlando. If that's her name.
Mirandola. Yeah. Mirandola.
Mirandola. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's like Miranda.
Yep.
Mirandola.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is like the Tempest.
Yes.
And think of that magical, strange land, too.
Yes. I love that.
So, Yeah, yeah, but anyway.
And I love that Mirandola wrote a letter or whatever and said, hey, you know how you were going to get that gold? I don't need that anymore. I need a potion.
Yeah.
And then he goes to the magician and says, hey, dude, how about we stop this gold talk and we do a potion and I should get my shadow back now.
Yeah, right? I would love to have to go back on this. Uh-huh. And the magician goes, oh, no, I've taught you a lot of things. but I know you can't make gold. Oh, but I taught you about matter. Uh-huh. And I taught you about all these things. He's like, none of these things matter to me. And he goes, but they're valuable. Yeah. You got them. You got that knowledge. Yeah.
Oh, that is so good.
Mirandola is the most clever person in the book, except for Father Joseph.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Well, and I also liked what the magician was doing with his spare time. I did not expect this at all. He's like walking to planets and things, spying on other races and spirits and stuff like this. And I was like, oh, he's like an explorer in that sense.
Yeah.
And that took him, yeah, but it was crazy. And it took him from being just a classic greedy magician to somebody who that was kind of like a side business.
Mm-hmm.
He would do it because that's what magicians do, of course. But what he really was interested in was all this other stuff. And that made him much more magical and mysterious to me.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Yeah. And this whole idea of these ages is, you know, I don't know if this is one of Tolkien's influences. Have no idea. But the idea of these ages, because in Tolkien's Middle Earth, there's ages. And, you know, in Lord of the Rings, it's like the passing of the Age of Elves, right? They're all leaving and stuff. So this idea that there's this golden age, and at the end of the book, the magician leaves, right? Not unlike the elves leave Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever.
This is before the Lord of the Rings.
It is, yeah. So, you know, this could have influenced Tolkien. But again, something influenced Dunsany. So, well,
but
knows?
I also think the idea of ages is just kind of a natural one. When we think about how
throughout history and Christian.
Europe has got all these different reminders of ancient times past, old walls, Roman mosaics and stuff. And the Norse people were the same, you know, the Northern myths. Yeah. So I think it's like, this is the age of heroes. Now we're in this age.
We're definitely in the age of heroes right now, I think. Isn't that right? That's where we're at.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at that. That's I thought you were joking, but you were serious. I could tell you were serious.
Oh yeah, so very. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what kind of heroes. Is this the heroes of jesters? Because I believe we're seeing many jesters displayed before us as purveyors of wisdom.
Oh, that's right. In here, you know, the age, the golden age moves on, and it doesn't actually say what the next age is, I don't believe. But in Tolkien, it was the age of man, I think, was what was coming.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I loved, you know, again, these little details, like when Ramon is learning how to make the love spell, it's basically a recipe. And, you know, there's some dust of Helen, some dust of Pharaoh, dust of Ozymandias, and crocodile's tears. I don't know. I love that stuff. It was very, very interesting. And then, again, Father Joseph's rejection of all of that as outside what you're doing, right? You're putting something else in charge of you. This is not God. That's, you know, so it was interesting. You know, I don't recall Father Joseph saying anything about God. It's like Father Joseph is kind of the stand-in or representative of Christianity that they are all responding to, or I don't know, paying homage to. I'm trying to think of the right word there. Cause they do go to him, like Ramon goes to Father Joseph as an authority. And I thought that his talk about the pen was interesting because Ramon wanted to learn how to use a pen. He wanted to learn how to write. But Father Joseph was questioning, why do you want to learn how to write? You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
And Father Joseph even said something like, everything that needs to be written has been written. Early on in the story, Father Joseph is helping his dad write a letter. And he said, I will happily do that for you, you know. So that was an interesting thing. And I'm convinced that what Father Joseph said there about everything having been written, he was talking to Ramon. He was saying, what I suspect that you want this for is something that you ought not do.
Yeah.
And, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think Father Joseph's influence in general is guiding everyone because this is what happens if you have a good priest, a good, solid person you can trust for spiritual advice, the church, who mm-hmm. is our mother, who we can trust for that advice. We are flawed in it, of course, but the church itself is here to help us get to heaven. That's the only reason the church is here.
Mm.
And so one thing that struck me is when Ramon is trying to learn, let's see, I can't remember which part of the book this is in, and this is the problem with having a Kindle
mm-hmm.
experience, is I forgot to make notes, but this is right before he gets his shadow back, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so it's the master is teaching him, and it says, against this terrible fame of what the master is saying you're going to be able to do, the young man's blood cried out, and the birds aided him, calling out of the wood, and the sunlight seemed on his side and against magic. And it says that, and it makes me think about how everything natural is pointing out to him, like, you know, he lost his shadow. Everything natural is pointing out to him, you don't need all this other stuff.
Hmm.
It's dangerous to you. And then, so then he asks the master a question he wouldn't have dared ask before. It says, the master was teaching him slowly a spell of terrible potency when Ramon Alonso said, Master, what chances of salvation hath a man that shall make use of this spell? Salvation, salvation, said the master, a thing common to countless millions, the ordinary experience hereafter of half the human race. Is this to be put against knowledge of the hour of return of the comet, against speech from these small fields with spirits that wander from world to world, against strange runes, knowledge of ancient histories, visions of future wars, the course of a star? So I'm kind of skipping forward. But, you know, these are all things that we strive to learn, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What were the ancient people saying? What is the course of a star? And it's very poetically put, and of course magical as it's put here. But he's saying, who cares about salvation? That's nothing. And so what I liked is after he got done, all that Ramon is thinking of is working on that lock.
Mm.
And he's working on the lock. And it won't open. And it says, more weary hours passed with the heathen arts of Persia. Ramon Alonso thinking all the while of heaven as a boy in school thinks of the green fields. And I thought, I love that that has become his dream. As a boy thinks of the school, you know, boy stuck in school thinks of the green fields. He's thinking of heaven.
Mm.
Salvation, which is common to half of the people alive, says the magician.
Yeah.
Is what Ramon wants. Mm. And maybe the half of the people that don't get it want it too.
Yeah.
Is what I'm thinking.
Me too.
But see, these are all things that, because of Father Joseph's influence, are under the surface.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was a time too, just before that, where Father Joseph sought Ramon out in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And so he arrives, and Ramon sits up from his mossy seat, doffs his hat, and says, what brings you to the wood? Said Ramon. And Father Joseph beamed towards him with his red face. I came to see you, he said. And then again, Ramon Alonso doffed his hat. And what brought you to me? He said. Peril of your soul, said Father Joseph, jovially. Ramon Alonso was silent a while. Have I imperiled it? He asked lamely. Have you had no dealings with the black art? Smiled Father Joseph. None to risk my salvation, said the young man. "Let us see," said Father Joseph. And thereupon he made the sign of the cross before Ramon Alonso, at which, though Ramon Alonso did not see it, for his face was toward the sun, the false shadow fell off from his heels.
That's it.
Isn't that awesome? And then Father Joseph took a bottle of holy water. So it was good. Cast the holy water upon the moss round his heels.
Yeah.
Yep. So.
It can't come back.
Exactly. But, you know, these feelings like, you know, it says here, you know, "What brings you to the woods?" said Ramon Alonso uneasily. "For every dealing with magic leaves its trace on the conscience." And, that's great. Well put. But it lends itself to the idea of what the shadow is representing, at least in my mind.
Yeah, and you don't,
throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to not think of that because, okay, let me just say this in a different way. I tend to not think of Lord Dunsany's stories having layers that even include anything like this,
mm-hmm.
because I've never read a book by him before. I've read short stories. And the short stories, as you know, tend to be almost snippet-like sometimes, but they're usually just kind of looking at very creepy worlds or situations that are almost like a weird cross between Fawford and the Grey Mouser world and H.P. Lovecraft somehow.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Right. I do know what you mean. Yeah. That's really well put. Because there's something about this, you know, because I'm going through Fawford and the Grey Mouser now, and these are new to me. So I've read 1.5 volumes so far.
Okay.
But there's just, again, there's something about these stories that just feels old. It just feels like it's touching something that maybe humans held in common or something, you know? And that's the way everything I've read by Dunsany so far has got that feeling for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, whether his writings commonly have this, like I'm thinking of The King of Elfland's Daughter, I don't recall religious content in there, but yet it is related, you know? The fact that there is an
story
Elfland.
Like this one?
Is it like this one? It's not. It's about a guy who wants to marry someone from Elfland. So he sends his son to Elfland to get her and bring her back to the world, which he does. But she is very unhappy in this world and then has to go back. So
the Little Mermaid, in a sense.
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe.
Not really,
but the whole idea of the Elfland, I mean, it reminds me a little bit about, I don't know if you've read that Unknown Caddoth by Lovecraft or the Nightland. there's just this.
I read part of the Nightland, and then when my brains ran out of my ears, I had to quit.
Yeah, there's something to, I don't know, it's like, I don't know, you have like Olaf Stapleton, and you have Hodgson, you know, the Nightland, and then like Lovecraft and At the Mountains of Madness, they're really just, the whole thing is looking around. You know, there's hardly anything going on except looking around. So
I have noticed that.
Yeah. So there's something about those, you know, and I don't know. I would imagine that most of that type of thing that I would read would not be engaging, but somehow they are. Yeah.
Well, it's the thing. I like the looking around in the stories that you mentioned that I've read.
Yeah.
But I think that's where eventually I'm lost or I drop it because but nothing's happening.
Right. There's really no plot, really. I mean, did you, I assume maybe you haven't, but have you read At the Mountains of Madness?
I feel like I have.
Yeah.
I feel like
it's the one that takes place in the South Pole. And it's really like them discovering something at the South Pole. Like a whole archaeological site.
Yes,
and
as always.
Walking around, checking it out. Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just didn't know if you'd read that. I was curious if you liked it or not.
I prefer the ones where something happens.
Yeah,
like,
well, sure.
The guy playing the piano, Zahn, what is it?
Yeah, the music of Eric Zahn.
That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
I prefer those.
For
but
sure.
Again, those are short stories, and so they've got to make something happen.
Yeah, At the Mountains of Madness is probably a novella.
Yeah.
So there was, for a long time, Guillermo del Toro was trying to make At the Mountains of Madness, but just never pulled it together. I think he's making Frankenstein right now. Yeah, so we'll see what he does with it.
If he keeps the moral hinging, I'll be interested.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also saw his take on the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Mm.
The Shape of Water?
The Shape of Water, the one in Oscar, didn't it?
Maybe, but it did not deserve to. I do not care. That's why we watched it, and I highly disapproved, and then went and watched the original one, which was actually really good, although... Yeah, no moral anything there. Just a terrible monster. But anyway.
Yeah.
So I guess that's kind of why I like this one better. Mm-hmm. In the sense of there's a lot of looking around. There's a lot of, description, as I said. But there is a storyline. There are interesting people. Mm-hmm. There is a moral underpinning. And it doesn't, a story doesn't have to have a moral underpinning I approve of. Yeah. It just has to have something.
Yeah.
When you get to the stories where all you're doing is looking around, you don't have anywhere to put your feet.
Mm.
I don't know if that's a good way to put it.
No, it is a good way to put it. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I remember when I first read The Nightland, how surprised I was that I was liking it.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, there wasn't a lot there. It was like, check this place out,
Yeah, but the way they're written about is interesting, and it's showing you something that's so different than anything you usually would ever even think of.
Yeah.
That's kind of the appeal, and that's the appeal of the magician to me. The things he's looking at and interested in and the way it's described. I mean, it wasn't until I was reading that one bit aloud that I was going, oh, these are all things we do now, but it's so poetically put that I hadn't recognized it until now. It's just, exploring the universe and all this with his soul, I suppose. And one of the things I liked about the magician, or even the story maybe, is except for one character, I don't think anyone can really be called evil. And that one character is Gonsalvo.
Yeah, right.
He wants the three pieces of fair land and the beautiful girl, and you feel like he's not going to be very nice to her.
Right.
But
he wants the stuff.
He does. He wants all the stuff. Mm. And he himself is not a very appealing person. But the magician is not really evil. He's greedy. He wants the shadows because they'll go off and see things for him. He is often very affable, and he'll stop and tell you about the philosophy of boar hunting and his happiness and this and that. So he's more of an intellectual character than anything else.
Mm.
I don't know. So I thought it was interesting because everything wound up okay.
Yeah.
He wound up okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ramon and the charwoman are fine. Mirandolo is fine.
Yeah. And I loved that too at the end. When Ramon is off. So Mirandola is going to marry the Duke now. And they're together, and Ramon is off in the trees trying to get her attention. I thought that was a cool scene.
Yes.
And then she walks right up with the Duke and says, forget this privacy stuff. He's my husband, or going to be, and there's nothing secret. So he's forced to say right in front of them both, hey, I want to marry this girl. And she's not of noble birth, or however they put it. And
dad's not into it.
Yeah, right. So the Duke says, oh, I'll take care of that. I'll write a letter to the king, or I can't remember what they called it, the Lord.
Right.
I'll write a note, and I'm sure that he'll be fine with it. And he was. It was just solved. I mean, it just shows you sometimes, like, you trying to sneak around is not the right thing to do. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
There was this line that I just loved. So the Duke doffed his hat. There's some more doffing of a hat. The Duke doffed his hat and bowed, and Mirandola went up and kissed Anemone.
Which is the charwoman's real name.
Right. Yeah. So I must wed illustriously, said Ramon Alonso in bitterness. And then this line right here. During one of those brief moments that destiny uses often to perfect an event with which she will shape the years. None of them spoke. I like that line a lot.
Yeah.
Although yeah. I wouldn't use destiny. I'd use God right there. But
yeah.
But I love the line. And then the detail of, okay, so the archbishop came in and married the duke to Mirandola. And then Father Joseph, in a tiny ceremony, married Anemone, the charwoman, and Ramon. I just liked that little detail. I thought that was pretty cool.
And then he did that too.
Yeah. So right, yeah. Father Joseph, way to go, man. High five for Father Joseph.
Exactly.
Yep. And then it says, of the magician. And then we learn where the magician went. So, which is like off to another place.
Well, I also liked that he goes outside and now I can't remember if he calls anyone, but as he's going, all the little hoofed creatures, all the little spirits, they come and start following him.
Yeah.
And it's like a Pied Piper moment. But what it really is, since we find out at the end, it's the end of the Golden Age. It's everyone who's like him who won't belong here later.
Right. Right.
They can go follow him if they want. And he walks through all these places, always says, guided by the dawn, always due eastwards.
Yeah.
And it says he's tired, but he's walking through the night. And it says, weariness came on him, and still he strode on, going homeless by quiet hamlets in the night, and waking new desires by the mere soft sound of his footfall and the scurrying of little hooves that always followed his journey. And then it says he can tell. It's the mortal tremors are coming upon him, which are the end of all mortal journeys or earthly journeys. And so then he hurries. It says, right before human destiny overtook him. So right before he dies, he saw one morning clear where the dawn had been the luminous rock of the bastions and glittering rampart that rose up sheer from the frontier of the country towards moon's rising. This he saw, though his eyes were dimming now with fatigue and his long sojourn on earth. Yet if he saw dimly, he heard with no degree of uncertainty the trumpets that rang out from those battlements to welcome him after his sojourn. And all that followed him gave back the greeting with such cries as once haunted valleys at certain times of the moon. Upon those battlements and by the opening gates were gathered the robed masters that had trafficked with time and dwelt a while on earth and handed the mysteries on and had walked round the back of the grave by the way that they knew and were even beyond damnation. They raised their hands and blessed him. And now for him and the creatures that followed after, the gates were wide that led through the earthward rampart of the country towards moon's rising. He limped toward it with all his magical following. He went therein, and the Golden Age was over.
Hmm.
And it's just,
end. Yep.
I didn't mean to read all that, but I couldn't stop.
No, it's terrific.
What I was thinking as I was reading it is, it's almost like, you're right, it is like Tolkien, but it's also kind of like the Book of Revelation.
Mm.
This is the chosen people, and he isn't by no means a chosen person, but it's shown here, he is, of what he is worthy. The humans don't understand him. He doesn't understand the humans, I think, as well as he wants. He's set apart. And he was trying to make Ramon into that, not because he didn't like Ramon, because he wanted him to be one of the greatest magicians ever, which he had the potential for. But that didn't happen. It was time to go. It was time he was going to die. And he goes on. And so it's almost like it's welcoming a saint into heaven.
Mm.
Just in the feeling, the grandeur of it.
Beautiful. Love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really good. Yeah. That's nice. I'm glad you read that. But yeah. Yeah, and it's easy to see, you know, Tolkien could have been influenced here or by a common influence with Lord Dunsany. Not sure.
Yes, there's a book, I think it's called Tales Before Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
I have not.
Let me look for this
real quick. I'd be interested in that. Is it full of this kind of thing?
It is. It's. Let me just look real quick.
Tales
Because there's one about Lewis and one about Tolkien.
Okay. The Roots of Modern Fantasy is a subtitle.
Yeah. Okay, so there's Tales Before Tolkien and Tales Before Narnia, and they're both put together by Douglas A. Anderson, I believe.
Cool.
So the idea is these are either stories that we know that these two people read, or that were around and in the air at the time.
Cool. So I'm looking at an ISFDB just to see if we, so we got a table of contents here. So I see George MacDonald, William Morris, H. Rider Haggard, E. Nesbitt.
Frank R. Stockton, I think.
Yeah, there's Lord Dunsany is there. Chubu yeah. and Shemish is the name of the story from 1911.
Didn't we talk about that story about the two little gods that were fighting each other?
Hmm.
And they would cause tiny little earthquakes.
Oh, nice.
That's one of my favorites. Oh, it's really
love that.
Funny.
I don't think I've read that. I'm going to grab that.
I thought maybe I'd picked it for a Halloween one. Now I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't recall that, but I could be wrong.
Well, read it anyway.
Yeah,
so,
I will. I have it.
Yeah, and so Tales Before Narnia. Let's see if I can find. I don't see a table of contents.
Arthur Macken is there. Okay. A. Merritt. Very good. So I'll look this up. I'm on ISFDB. Tales Before Narnia. Tales Before Narnia. That would be fascinating because there's probably some Christian stuff here.
Well, yeah. Well, of course, you know George MacDonald's got to be there.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's see.
George MacDonald, Owen Barfield, Charles Dickens.
E. Nesbitt.
Yep. Or Robert Louis Stevenson. There's even a poem Hans by Christian. Tolkien. There's some G.K. Chesterton.
Kenneth Graham.
Yep.
Very
good.
All kinds of stuff.
Wow, I didn't know about those. I'm going to get them both.
Oh, well, yeah, and this makes me think I got these and read them some time ago, just on Kindle. I'm pretty sure they're on Kindle. Yeah. And so I read through them and was really interested in just thinking about these stories being out there.
Mm.
And maybe I'll read those again. I'm interested in your list, the Ballantine books.
Yeah, okay.
So
I can send you that. There's a it's a Wikipedia entry.
Okay.
And it's got them all in there.
We should
so I'll
put,
email
if
that
we,
to you. Sure, I will.
Yeah, we should put these three things in the story notes.
Yeah, we'll do.
Yeah.
I love it. Very good.
Yeah. Just all that cross-pollination going on.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thanks for reading this with me.
Well, I'm glad you chose it because, as I say, I hadn't read any of his books. I've just read short stories.
It's not too long. It's about 200 pages, I'd say.
Yeah, it was a quick read. If you even reading it in pieces like I did.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
So good. Well, good. All right. So what is next up for us? It is Willie Shakes.
And his jolly, jolly masterpiece.
That's
King
right.
Lear, right?
King Lear.
Can't wait for that.
King Lear, yeah.
Really looking forward to that upbeat
love
piece.
It.
Sorry.
I love it.
Do so, you?
Yeah,
I've
I
never
do.
Seen it. So,
oh, okay. I love it.
I know the gist.
Yeah, for sure. That, yeah, it's one
it
of those
uncheerful.
That's kind of in the air.
Well,
but,
yeah, it is.
So we'll talk about the one Ian McKellen. Playing King Lear.
Okay.
Yep. And I think that's a BBC Shakespeare company, if I remember right. So.
I think it is, because I was looking at it thinking that, you picked a play again.
Way to go, Scott. Way to go.
Not a movie, a play.
That's right.
I'm hoping that there's more than a black stage and a bunch of people sitting around on pillars. But
me too.
I can't argue a success. It still sticks in my mind. So it was good.
That's good. I'm glad.
Yeah. No, it was good.
You bet. Well, cool. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
All
it'll
right.
be something real different in a sunny August conversation.
Love it. All right. Well, we'll talk to you in a couple weeks, everybody.
Yeah.
Thanks
we'll
for
see,
listening.
Talk to you soon. Okay.
Bye-bye.